Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 346.
This week on the podcast, Bernie is out, but guys, you can still vote in your primary and you can still vote your principals.
And we've got thoughts on Biden's binders full of women.
Plus, the GOP to Wisconsin voters drop dead.
And rampant inequality in life leads to rampant inequality in deaths.
America's president is currently the governor of California. Act accordingly.
And we've got a slice of normalcy in these trying times. Our yearly Easter Q&A.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
Welcome to our yearly Easter podcast.
We're in our
finest Easter wear.
Yeah, if you're watching us on YouTube, we're wearing the same shirt.
And that's right.
We're just going with it. It's our squad shirt here. I'm going to show people if you are watching on YouTube. We're both in the same shirt. So
that's right.
You know, it happens sometimes.
Periodically. More than I would imagine.
Not more than I would imagine.
Yeah, it's like the best shirt that we have, both of us. So like what? So you got to wear your favorite shirt sometimes.
Right.
We have also narrowly avoided wearing it out in public at various times. At least now we don't have that danger.
Yeah, it's true.
But we needed to lift our spirits because it was a sad week for those of us in the squad community. Because Bernie Sanders officially dropped out of the presidential race.
Yeah. Came as a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
Everybody knew it was coming at some point. And like he had sort of really stopped campaigning quite a while ago. He was using his campaign to fundraise for, you know, nonprofits and things like that, and sort of had not said anything bad about Joe Biden in a solid since whenever that last debate was.
Yeah.
So, you know, not shocking, but it did sort of like to a degree come out of the blue that I woke up that morning and I was like, oh shit.
It wasn't the playbook that we were used to seeing from him. And I think it's largely a response to the fact that he now, in dealing with this pandemic as a senator, just has too many things on his plate. I think they were just sort of like, we can't also spend all of this time running a losing campaign.
I agree. If we're looking for a conspiracy theory, I have one, which is probably not necessarily accurate, because I don't know that this really sort of like fits into sort of like Bernie's whole situation that he's, you know, doing. But, you know, we talked last week about how Biden called him the week before to sort of like sheepishly tell him that he was looking for a VP candidate and also trying to fill cabinet positions. I mean, if the man is looking to fill a cabinet position, one way that you might get an opponent to drop out of a presidential race is to offer one of those cabinet positions to him.
Yeah. I feel like the only thing that I hope wasn't the case, but feels like it would be right up the DNC alley, is offering him like a fake cabinet position for a position they made up, which is what they did in the Senate, where they were like, we're putting Bernie Sanders in Senate leadership. And they like made up a fake outreach position.
Which
is not the same thing as having him, you know, be part of leadership in a meaningful
sense. Actually sort of like getting to drive policy.
Right. It was like, we'll let you explain our policy to other people, but you can't help us come up with it. So I hope that if he did that, it was like a real cabinet position and not bullshit.
Right.
But I mean, I'm hoping that they're thinking, I am not one for a team of rivals version of, you know, politics. But I'm hoping that they have been thoughtful about how they conceive of building an administration and have made it clear early on to their opponents that they intend to build an administration that does feel like it represents the actual tent that they're representing, which is so far to the left of where they stand right now that they really do need to make meaningful offers to some of these progressive figures, not even the candidates, but figures in order to bridge that gap. And they need to be clear about that early on. They can't pretend like they haven't thought about this and then spontaneously just remake up the Obama administration, which, I mean, at this moment in time would be such a colossal mistake given how many of them, A, went to go work in corporate America.
Right.
And B, you know, advocate for a kind
They went back to work in corporate
America. Back to work in corporate America.
Which is where they were.
But also, like, advocate a kind of recession policy that, you know, that offered bailouts to corporations and not people. I don't think we can do that again. So, in any case, I think there must have been something discussed between them. Sure. Because this was very early for Bernie to drop out.
Right. I will say, and this will be the last nice thing that I will say about him, because we're about to go on a rage tangent. That's right.
Get ready. An Easter rage tangent.
Right. So you've been warned. But I will say that, like, by the morning after the day that Sanders dropped out, we were already further along in sort of the reach out process than we ever got in the entire campaign of 2016.
That's right.
Now we're going to talk to you about what that is, because it's trash.
That's right.
But at least Biden acted like he got it. He doesn't, but he at least chose to pretend.
It only took him
one step past where we ever got.
That's right.
4 years
ago. So, it's not only one step past where we ever got with Clinton, it's one step past where Biden himself has ever found himself.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah.
That was good news. He made two policy announcements that were shifts for him.
Right. One of them is so stupid. And one of them is less stupid, but I just have thoughts of them together as a package. The first one was to lower the Medicare eligibility age to 60 from 65.
Like, fuck off. Unless you are telling me that's part of an ongoing policy where you're then going to lower it again the next year.
Right. It gets lowered to 50 the next year until we get down to everyone being covered.
Because let me also tell you where this ends. Because the Republicans have for a long time been advocating raising the eligibility age. So where this lands us is a compromise where we keep it at 65.
Probably.
So that's not a real policy. It's like nice that he recognizes that actions need to be taken on the healthcare front. But this is such a minimal action and it's so short of what's necessary. And he has been, you know, he's a guy who takes insurance money. He's a guy who's in the pocket of the insurance industry. He has been so short of what is needed for this moment for so long that for his reach across the aisle offer to be 5 years, lowering the Medicare eligibility rate by five years when... What if you have a heart attack at 55? Plenty of people do. Like, that doesn't do shit for you. Yeah. So but where that lands us is a compromise where we actually keep it the same.
Just keep it.
Just FYI to all. Totally. So that's a fake policy.
Right. And the other plan was a student debt cancellation forgiveness plan that basically gives all federal undergraduate student loans from 2 and 4 year colleges, and also any private universities or HBCUs, for debt holders who are earning up to $125,000. So if you're earning less than that right now, then you have your state 2 or 4 year public college loans forgiven.
Right.
Which is a lot. That's going to affect a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that is not nothing. But it's important to put this in perspective, I think, because look, this happens every election, even with Hillary Clinton, who I only did it because I think the difference here is that we didn't have to beg and plead with him.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have to like make like a giant scene with him. Right. We didn't have to protest
his
events.
Right.
We didn't have to, you know, beg and plead to get people on the platform committee at the convention, which is sort of like what we had to do with her. But this happens every election. Even she came out with her free college plan, which was the same price point. It was basically free college for anyone in state making less than $125,000.
Yeah.
And it came, you know, it was too late and a dollar short. So again, he's off to a better start. But I think especially in the time that we're in now, people are getting it more.
Well, people, you know, also just rightfully expect more because we just invented trillions of dollars. So it turns out we've had the money the whole time.
That's the thing. And I think that, and not only that, you know, granted, his college debt forgiveness doesn't go as far as Sanders did. But he is a man who spent all of the primary telling everyone about how Sanders' plans were too expensive and how are we going to pay for them. Right. And as it turns out, he doesn't care how we're going to pay for them. I mean, he offered sort of a plan to pay for them by sort of repealing some tax cut on something or other or whatever. But you can't go around and say that we can't do this because it's pie in the sky, because we're not going to be able to pay for it, when A, you've already figured out how to pay for it yourself. And B, on top of that, considering the world that we're living in, we could just be making up trillions of dollars to be doing all of these things anyway.
Money's a construct. They just let us in on the big secret, which is that we made, I mean, this is a secret Brent and I have shared with you in the past, which is that we invented money. It's a system that was designed to make it possible for us to distribute goods and services and without having to use chickens.
Right.
It's for efficiency's sake. And we made the whole thing up. So we actually always have enough money to do whatever we want, as long as it's something that exists within the realm of a public investment that is worthwhile and pays dividends back to the society.
Yep.
You know, public education pays dividends. It's something that benefits the economy in the long run. And so we have literally always had the money to pay for that. Just as we've always had the money to pay for fire departments, because we have to have fire departments.
Right.
Like, we make up money, so we can make it up, basically.
Yeah.
That doesn't work for you personally, but it does work for the government.
But it's just so disingenuous for him to, 24 hours after Sanders dropped out, to adopt, not in full, but at least in part, one of his plans, after we got told for the better part of an entire year that none of those things were possible because they were all pie in the sky and you couldn't pay for any of them.
Well, I always resent
when... And then here we are, the next day,
when Democrats
we're paying
use Reaganomics arguments to discuss policy, when they tell you something costs too much instead of saying, let's figure out how we can make it work. When they, you know, because the other way to have this discussion has always been to say, of course, college should be free. How can we make that work? The first thing that we can do is make it free for people under $125,000 a year. That's our compromise point to begin with. And then we can work from there. Like, I think what frustrates me about the way that they discuss these programs that they claim, quote unquote, cost too much, is that what he's offering you is an endpoint that is short of the endpoint that is actually possible and necessary in this moment. And he's telling you that whatever he doesn't feel like offering costs too much, but he always is going to make a sort of, he's always going to make an excuse for whatever the politically expedient policy, the minimal thing that he can get away with is, because none of it costs too much. So it's made up.
And he knows that. And that's what we've just found out now, is that these things aren't too expensive. And you knew the whole time that they weren't too expensive. And you were lying to us about them being too expensive. And you knew you were lying to us about them being too expensive.
Well, it turns out that you, as you've released, have a plan to pay for it. Turns out that we've all had a plan already. Also, I have another thing to say about people having plans to pay for things, which is anyone who has told me after the Trump-era tax cuts that they can't figure out how to pay for a massive public expenditure can literally go fuck off and die. Because we gave huge corporate tax cuts to, you know, untold numbers of corporations and wealthy people. And there is money then to play with, because we somehow continued to have a society after that.
Yep.
It was a very unequal society. It was not a society where people were living good lives. But I mean, if you can continue to have a society after that, then you can start to tax those people again and find the money.
Yeah.
The money, we gave the money back to those people. We didn't have to.
Right.
We gave them the idea of money in the first place. We made up money. The money doesn't belong to them. It belongs to all of us. The only reason we have money is so that we can share things.
Right.
It's not so that people can hoard it.
Yeah. And so, lastly, on the subject, well, we're going to move on to sort of like how to talk to Bernie supporters.
Discussion.
But just before we sort of like talk about like what Biden's doing here with his sort of like quote unquote olive branch to progressives, you can't offer that on one day and then literally the next day be in the news because Michael Bloomberg's firm is bidding to run your campaign. You can't we're not stupid. And in fact, not only are we not stupid, we're going to be less likely to vote for you if you treat us like you think we are.
Yeah.
So it's you got to.
Voters
and
did
look,
make.
He's gotten a lot of blowback for that. And he may say, look, I can't have you guys running my campaign. And I hope that's what he does.
Yeah.
But like, you know, you can't be doing that kind of stuff if you're thinking that you're doing outreach to progressives. It's not going to work.
Voters made something very clear to the remaining Democratic candidates in the post-Bloomberg world, which was that they were not interested in having a billionaire have his hand in the race.
Right. Certainly not a Republican one.
Certainly not. But not, I mean, Tom Steyer did not get welcomed into the race.
No, he didn't.
But these people are welcome to donate, you know, no strings attached money if they want. But the voters made very clear that they weren't interested in Michael Bloomberg's strings.
Yeah.
And so it shows a tremendous misread of what we learned from this cycle, And we could have learned more, except that everyone fucking dropped out before anyone got a chance to vote. You know, it's like the absence of data somehow makes it possible to pretend like there's no data.
Right.
It's, you know, we face this all the time on the 9/11 health front. They don't do research on women's health. And then they're like, well, we can't cover women's conditions. There's no research on it. And it's like, well, that was your responsibility to fund. That is what you do. So, you know, in the same way, we can't pretend like we can't draw conclusions about what we did learn from the race because not everyone got a chance to vote in it. But we also shouldn't pretend like we couldn't have learned more. Right. But in any case, the voters are very clear about this. Michael Bloomberg's hand does not belong in this race. They did not want him to be involved in this race. No. The man couldn't buy the election, and he's not going to be able to buy Biden the election. And he's not, as it turns out, the strategies that his firm and his campaign were using to win people these elections were not strategies that actually worked, because you can't sell something no one wants, even if you have all the money in the world. Like, you
right.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
Our second discussion on this point has to do with how you can talk to depressed Sanders voters in your life. Because I think that there is this sense, and it exists on both sides, but one side is always winning and one side is always losing. So it matters that it exists on both sides, that righteous anger only belongs to the middle or to the left. Hmm. We both feel angry. So the first thing that you should do when you're talking to the Sanders voter in your life is recognize that they too have righteous anger, and that their righteous anger is probably angrier than yours, but at this moment, but certainly is as righteous as yours. So if you are somebody who is walking around furious at Bernie voters for not voting for the candidate that you prefer, just know that those Bernie voters think that you want them dead. So, their righteous anger does feel personal as well. So it is not the responsibility of Team Biden to shame Sanders voters into voting for them, to blackmail right. Sanders voters into voting for them. It is their responsibility to make a positive case for Biden. And I think a lot of them don't understand how to do that. Because
I think they don't understand the language that
we're looking to hear.
I agree. I do think that there might be a little bit of leadership on that front from the candidate himself.
Yeah.
Just because he's going to be nicer to Bernie than Clinton ever was, if for no other reason only than that they just happen to be personal friends.
Right.
And she couldn't stand the sight of him.
Exactly.
So I'm hoping that maybe that will drive the response from his supporters a little bit in this. I don't know that it will necessarily.
Well, I think they were trained in bad habits literally dating back to Bush v. Gore. The entire Democratic establishment has literally just developed bad habits around talking about elections. And I think that's something that, Biden is a compromised candidate. He's going to have a tough time winning. And if you really want him to win, then A, from your perch, make sure that he adopts policies that you can pitch to Bernie voters, for sure. Right. But also think really critically about how you're approaching those voters. And I think that the one thing that I think there's two things that you can do. One is vote shaming is never okay. If you are mad that someone voted before for Bernie Sanders, keep that shit to yourself. If you are mad that, if you are going to tell someone that, do not tell anyone that their vote is electing Donald Trump. Do not tell anyone that by showing up to the polls, they will have a negative impact on the race. Your job as a Democrat is to get turnout. It is not to get people to not show up. Do not make a single Sanders voters, all of whom are progressives, feel that their vote is going to be destructive to the process, because those voters show up and vote Democratic down ballot. And that brings me to my second point.
There was a meme going around this week that I feel like speaks to this, that was just sort of like, a Biden supporter, or I don't even know if they were identified as a Biden supporter, but just sort of like, it was a cartoon, sort of like of all of the terrible things that have been said about Bernie Sanders, and about also how Bernie Sanders voters are stupid and, sold a bag of goods and like all of those things. And then at the end, it's like, but also vote for Biden or Trump's your fault.
Right. Exactly.
That's not going to do it.
And so I have a suggestion for this. I think that unfortunately for you, Biden community voters, you're going to have to figure out a way to sort of surreptitiously sell Biden by selling other candidates to us. Hmm. I think you let people have the dignity of a proactive vote. So instead of saying that they should make a defensive vote and the only argument you can think of for getting them to show up to the polls is a defensive vote, let them know about a race down ballot that they can feel good about voting for.
Totally.
Ask people in your life to make a positive, exciting vote down ballot, and don't fucking mention Joe Biden to them if they don't seem like they're going to be receptive to it. It's talk about the issues, not the candidate.
I agree. And like also, you know, I think first off, I think more Bernie supporters are probably going to vote for Biden.
Yeah.
Just because I think that there's like not a sort of, I mean, look, people don't love him, but like there's not sort of like an inherent, you know, hatred, which I think sort of existed previously. And also, I think that Bernie is going to be able to sort of like sell voting for Biden in a way that is probably a little bit easier than voting for Clinton. And only because we've sort of had 4 years of Donald Trump, you know, I think about sort of like going to Bernie rallies. And the thing that he always started with before he even talked about his own policies or anything else was just sort of like that his, you know, the thing that he wanted to do more than anything else was to defeat the most dangerous, you know, president that we've ever had in modern history. And I think that that is sort of what he is probably going to take out when he sort of like goes out in, you know, in favor of Joe Biden, because he will do that at some point. And I think that I think that his voters are going to be perhaps more apt to listen to that and also sort of like have their own hatred of Donald Trump. I'm not saying that they are all going to vote for Joe Biden, because I don't think that that's the case. But
I think that's not something for you, a random person, to worry about.
Right. That's
your
what
job
I'm
is
saying,
to worry.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, there's a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who sort of like are big into Rachel Bitecoffer, or Bitecoffer, excuse me, who is that, you know, political scientist who sort of like subscribes to the turnout model, and that's what wins elections. And so a lot of, you know, Sanders people sort of are like, well, Sanders is the one who's going to drive turnout. But actually, really sort of like when you get down to it, what she says is that it's negative partisanship that drives turnout. And that is why she sort of like had so many blue congressional seats flipping in 2018.
Yeah.
She was really the only one that got anywhere near the amount, because everybody else sort of like pulled back from their expectations as it got closer. And she, I think, estimated 41, and I think there were 40 or something like that. Anyway, so I think that there will be a lot of people who sort of, I wish we sort of weren't having to test that theory out so much at its core, because we have a candidate who is not going to drive turnout. So we are really, like, this is going to be an election that we will know whether she's a genius or not at the end of, because the only reason that anybody's going to vote for anybody is going to be either in favor of or against Donald Trump. But I think there will be enough Bernie supporters who probably go out there and vote for Joe Biden just literally because, like, what are they going to, like...
I think that the question is not actually about that, because these are all people who are engaged in the process. The question is about...
No, I agree with you.
Voters.
I'm just saying, like, I think that people who are... There's going to be... The reason that people are going to shame us is because they're going to be worried that we're not going to do what they want. And what my response to that is like, back off. I got it. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like,
and
not everybody's going to think that. Like, some people might vote third party. I might vote third party. But what I'm saying is that, like, just, I'm basically saying the same thing as you. Just, like, don't talk about it.
Yeah. Well, just let us have a dignified vote.
Right. Exactly.
That's, don't
and if
pre-shame
we want that
us.
To be for Joe Biden, we might. I think a lot of us will.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think also the other thing that you can do is if you insist on talking about Joe Biden with someone who does not want to hear about Joe Biden and... recognize that right now people are pretty sensitive.
Well, right. So, wait a minute.
And also, half the country got their primary vote basically pulled out from under them.
Totally.
So half the country is rightfully angry. And one thing, I mean, Sanders has said in some of those states, vote for him anyway to let them know that those people that you were here.
Right.
Because just because he is not sort of actively participating in the race doesn't mean that Joe Biden doesn't need to know that this state votes to the left.
Yeah.
But also, be willing to admit that Biden is going to need many checks. Don't sort of convince us that the work that we've all done to drag Biden to the left should be rewarded by chastising us for not doing enough. Admit that the reason we want to show up is actually because you know that Biden's going to need checks. So let's make sure that the right people are in there checking him. Biden is not going to do this. He's not going to do right by his own, on his own.
He's not equipped to.
He's not equipped to. His instincts are far to the right of what the nation is looking for.
Yeah.
So it is worth it to admit that you know that you are asking us to make a compromise choice and that you have figured out how we can mitigate that choice. And another thing also that that political scientist said is that the VP pick matters almost more than the candidate does.
It does.
And on that note, we should talk about the VP stakes, because the one area where Biden could really gain momentum or lose everything is in the same place that Hillary Clinton first slapped the left in the face.
Right.
Which is in his VP pick.
Right.
I think, you know, he says he's going to pick a woman. There's many women that he could choose from, and some of them would be the wrong woman to choose from.
I know. And it's weird because I had a friend of mine, actually, it's a mutual friend of ours, asked me who I thought the VP pick was going to be. And I'd been thinking about it a lot, but for whatever reason, she caught me at a time where I was, well, any time is a time that I'm ready to chat because I'm not doing anything else.
Right.
But I like went on such a tear about it, not like in a, you know, negative way or anything like that, but like I sent her like a million text messages back, and then she was like, sorry to trigger you. And I was like, oh no, you didn't trigger me. I just like, I have all the thoughts about it because it's weird. It's bothering me also that like, I can't get my own head around it. Like usually I ever know who anybody is going to pick, but I feel like I have sort of like a good sense of like, oh, that person would be a good person. I got a list of 15 people in front of me, and I got a good reason that all of them are the wrong person. I mean, I could make a case for some of them also, like they're all perfectly capable. But I don't know. I can't make sense of which is the right person on the list.
Well, let's read you the list.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at a list that you
don't
a
know.
Listener, cannot see. So the list of people, we've compiled a list of people that are being discussed.
Right. This is sort of like a master list from every single, you know, reputable source that I could find that is sort of like weighing in on what the list is. And the core list is basically the same. There's a few randos on here that it's probably not going to be. But like this is essentially the list that's the list.
Yeah. So the list is Stacey Abrams, which we know, common topic of discussion. Val Demings, who's that Florida House member who was on the impeachment panel. Michelle Lujan Grisham, she's the governor of New Mexico.
Yep.
And she's Brent's dark horse.
She might be who I think is the best choice right now. We'll come back to why.
Okay. Tammy Baldwin, senator from Wisconsin. She would be the first LGBT candidate. Tammy Duckworth, who I had been advocating as a potential running mate for Elizabeth Warren. I will explain why I feel very differently about pairing her with Biden.
Yep.
Keisha Lance Bottoms, who's the mayor of Atlanta, early supporter of Biden's. Elizabeth Warren, Catherine Cortez Masto, first Latina to be elected to the Senate. And Biden, she's on the short list, Biden has said.
Yeah.
Amy Klobuchar, Gretchen Whitmer, Kamala Harris, Ayanna Pressley, and Maggie Hassan, the New Hampshire senator.
Yeah.
So,
should we just go through them?
Let's go through them. Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny because Stacey Abrams was the leader on this category or, on this list for so long. But I think the times have really changed sort of where, like, in most of these lists that you look, she sort of is now at the bottom and she was at the top of them. And I think it's just because her experience level, I think, is being questioned in sort of like the times that we're in right now. We're looking at Joe Biden, who's going to be the oldest president ever inaugurated if he wins. And like, we're seeing what a lack of executive experience is doing to the country right now. I mean, we already knew, but now we really know. And I just, you know, the highest position that she's ever held was, you know, in the Georgia State House. I just don't know. Look, would she be a more capable president than Donald Trump? Certainly. But I just don't know if she's going to give everybody the feeling of comfort in a leader in a time of crisis that we're in right now that maybe needs to be on the ticket.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to be her.
I think 3 months ago, I
would have thought that it was going to be her.
I feel the same way. I feel like there's a really strong chance that he picks a governor. Because governors are having a moment.
I think so, too. Val Demings is on this list. She was on the list as an outsider choice.
Yeah.
I don't care. It's not going to be her. Although, you know, she's black. She's from Florida. She was, like, the first female police chief in Orlando or something like that, I think. So, like, she's got some credibility. She's new to the House, though. So, like,
yeah.
I don't know. I also sort of, like...
Her experience level is not going to be up to the moment that we're in.
Right. I agree. So, Michelle Lujan Grisham is the governor of New Mexico. The reason why she's my dark horse is for the reason that you just said, is that she is a governor, and I agree that executive experience is going to be important here. And she, I don't know anything about her. The only thing that I know about her is she is the governor of New Mexico, and that she is also a Latina. She's the only Latina governor that we have right now. And that I have said a million different times. I think a lot of people think that just sort of like to show, you know, sort of to give the Black community sort of, you know, a shout out with the VP choice because of, you know, how they basically like got him the nomination here. But like, I would say inversely to that argument that he doesn't need to do that because they're going to vote for him anyway. Like, clearly they love him.
And,
you know?
And who, so, the people who have not voted for him in such high numbers are Latino voters.
Latinas. Yeah. They don't particularly care for him, and for good reason. So I like, you know, and look, maybe she's a dud. I literally don't even know. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you anything about her at all.
Yeah.
But anyway, I like it. If I'm having to pick a dark horse, which I like,
that's
to
your
pick,
dark horse.
That's it. Anyway.
As now the Tammys.
The Tammys.
Listen, I had made a strong argument for Tammy Duckworth to be Liz Warren's running mate, and I did that because Tammy Duckworth is far to the right of Liz Warren. She is also, she's a woman of color. She is a quadriplegic.
Right.
She's a veteran. She's a DAR member. I mean, she's literally both old America and new America wrapped up into one.
And she's a real good attack dog.
She's a great attack dog and a brilliant speaker. And I also think that for Joe Biden to choose her would be like the dumbest possible choice because she's to his right. And so the last thing that we need is like a pair of moderate Republicans trying to save us from a moment that has turned everyone into a socialist.
Yeah.
So I don't think she would be a great surrogate for whoever the candidate is. And she probably will be anyway.
I mean,
hopefully will be. I mean, she really is a brilliant speaker. But I think, you know, I think that in this moment where there's no one to the left to counterbalance her conservative hawkish views, I'm not interested in a Tammy Duckworth running mate.
Yeah. Tammy Baldwin, I think, is only on this list because she's a woman and Biden has said that it's going to be a woman and she's from Wisconsin.
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me, I don't think. I mean, she's...
That's not even a real discussion.
She's more boring than him. That doesn't make any sense.
No.
Doesn't make any sense.
That's a nothing choice.
Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor of Atlanta, I think that's sort of a very outside choice as well. She was, like you said, a very early supporter of his. She's Black.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, you're the mayor of a large city. That's executive experience. I don't know how it's going down there right now. I don't know. It just seems far-fetched. But, you know, maybe a far-fetched pick would be splashy. I don't know.
Yeah. There's the former running mates contingent, the former competitors contingent, the Liz Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Kamala Harris group.
Yeah.
I think of those three, I know that Kamala Harris dropped out early and endorsed him in a way that made me think he offered her something.
She is number one on every single one of these lists that you look at.
Yeah.
And I think that's
the dumbest choice that he could possibly make.
Yeah. And the reason that she gives me a little bit of pause, and I don't like this necessarily because it's not ultimately her fault, but she is very polarizing. And I just think once we're getting down to sort of like banking our entire, you know, election on this sort of like negative partisanship, like I hesitate. I'm almost wondering, and I hate to say this because it goes against everything that I stand for. Is this, and feel free to, you know, debate me on this. Is now the time for a boring VP pick?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I feel like I could make a case for why it is.
I can figure out what the case would be for why it is. I think that the issue is that Joe Biden offers almost nothing of content himself.
I mean, I agree.
And picking a boring VP pick gives them nothing to campaign on.
I agree.
And if we're talking about a turnout model, what are they offering to people to offer an alternative to this moment? I mean,
not Trump.
I don't think that's enough. Hillary Clinton wasn't Trump. And I know that we have more experience with Trump right now, but I mean, we're really talking about we're talking about a situation in which people have gotten considerably more hopeless in the intervening years, considerably less interested in returning to the status quo that we had before Trump, because we're starting to see connections between how that status quo has laid the groundwork for the moment that we're in now. I think that you do not pick someone who does. I mean, I think that's what that was Hillary Clinton's big mistake. She picked a candidate so boring that in 3 years, we're not going to be able to remember who she ran with. I forget his name almost daily. I mean, it's astonishing how forgettable he was. And having someone that forgettable does not leave room for an ongoing conversation about that person. So
yeah.
When you have a Joe Biden who is like a nothing candidate for most of his own base, you know, and then and to pick a running mate that offers nothing new to the ticket, to pick a running mate that doesn't even offer some sort of, you know, some sort of splashy thing that the left can rally around in some way would be, I think, a huge mistake on his part. Now, the thing about Kamala Harris, I would say, though, is that she doesn't offer that. Kamala Harris does not offer him what he needs in order to pull the rest of these young left-wing voters along for the ride.
I agree.
Kamala Harris is an incredibly boring candidate, I actually think. I think that that is part of the struggle that she had finding her way in that presidential race. Yeah. She doesn't have... She's charismatic, but she's hesitant on policy. She doesn't really stand for anything. I think he needs to find someone who stands for something. I mean, Even Amy Klobuchar stands for something, and I certainly don't think she'd be a good pick, but I mean, she's someone who I can tell you what her platform was, at least. I don't know what the hell Kamala Harris's platform was. Kamala Harris is not from a state.
Well, she didn't either. That was the problem.
Well, that's right. Kamala Harris doesn't come from a state that benefits him. She comes from a state that makes him look like the coastal elite.
Right.
And
she's a
and
senator.
I think her record
I don't feel like that.
Yeah, she's
makes
a young senator. She has less experience than a lot of people on this list, but also no executive experience, really, and sort of meaningfully no Senate experience because she's brand new to the Senate.
Yep.
And I think that she actually would be the kind of boring pick that he should avoid. I think that it's too bad because I was actually very excited when Kamala Harris got elected here, but I have not found her to be some sort of spectacular senator.
No.
She was great in one hearing, one time, basically. And that's why we know her name. But I think that he needs to pick somebody who brings to the table what he lacks, not someone who is so unnotable that we can't remember who's running against Donald Trump and therefore can't argue to anyone that they should vote for them. I think that's always the mistake.
You've convinced me. But the one thing that I don't want him to add to the ticket is someone that is going to drive people to vote against Biden. Because
I don't think that's a problem.
You're right. But I just feel like once the only thing that is going to win this election is our hatred of Donald Trump, which is basically like that's what we're banking our whole thing on right now, because nobody's going to go out there excitedly voting for Joe Biden. Like, I don't want the pick to be someone who is going to get everybody riled up to vote against Joe Biden.
Here's what I would say about this moment in time is that there is not a crossover contingent with these two candidates. So there is no danger of people getting riled up to vote against Joe Biden. There's a danger of them not showing up to vote for anyone.
Well, that's what I would like them to do.
But I think that you're more likely to get people motivated to the polls if you have something interesting for them to vote for than the absence. I mean, we've tried the strategy of running two boring candidates against terrible people again and again and again. We've also tried the strategy of picking someone to the right of an already far right Democrat. Both of those strategies have been abject failures every single time that we've tried them.
No, I don't disagree with you.
I think that the idea that I don't think we have to worry about people showing up to vote against Biden. I think we have to worry about them not showing up. And that concern to me is a lot greater if he doesn't bring anything to the race than it is if he brings something that is going to be a discussion point.
Yeah, I mean,
a discussion point gives us something to discuss.
You might very well be right. And that is what has been causing me such great stress about this. And this is this conversation that we're having right now is basically a repeat of the entire brain dump that I had yesterday where my friend was like, sorry to trigger you, because I agree with you, but I also agree with myself.
I would contend
I have
no stress about this. I have literally no disagreement about this.
I don't necessarily have stress about it. The only thing that is stressing me out is that, like, I can't figure it out.
I am more worried that Joe Biden won't figure it out.
Well, Joe Biden's not going to figure it out. Yeah, I just wish that I could.
I think that he needs to pick somebody who offers something to the left.
Well, who on this list is doing that for you?
I mean, I think there's not many people. Well, that's the problem. No, Ayanna Pressley offers something to the left.
Sure.
I think to some level, even
Stacey Abrams also has the same problem to Stacey Abrams. She's been in her first term, she's inexperienced.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I would say those candidates, the strength that they do bring to the ticket is that Joe Biden has a lot of executive experience of some sort.
Right, but he's 1,000 years old.
And I know, but I mean, I think that you don't necessarily, I think in this short-term moment, we're going to be thinking a lot about governors because governors are running the country right now. I think that there's a chance that he doesn't need an executive, you know, experienced person to be his running mate, because I think, I don't think that he wants to leave us with the presumption that he thinks he's going to die in office.
No, but Americans have that presumption, though.
And by the time that he dies in office, that person will have executive experience because they will be the vice president. So we have that. I think that in terms of a turnout model, you know, I think if he would be smart to play up his executive experience, and then would also be smart to find a running mate who plays up some of the soft skills that he lacks.
Right.
And I think because of that, I think he's I think he's likely to try to choose someone with executive experience. But I think that if he does that to the exclusion of finding someone interesting to choose, then he's playing with fire, because there is no room for a Tim Kaine in this year. There are lessons we can very easily learn from not just Clinton, but from history.
Yeah. No, we learned the lesson. And to your point, I'm almost wondering if that sort of like is helping make the case for this governor of New Mexico, if for the only reason that it's splashy just because nobody knows who she is.
Could be.
I mean, it's like she's the Sarah Palin pick, you know? I'm sure she's smarter than Sarah Palin, but I mean, like, do you remember all that sort of like initial sort of like, who is she? What's her deal? What's going on? Like, do we like her? Do we not like her?
Well, I think that a splashy choice isn't necessarily going to be a progressive choice, but that he has to make a splashy choice.
Right.
There is, like, otherwise he is literally absent from the public conversation right now.
Totally.
We have not seen or heard from him meaningfully in weeks.
No.
It feels like months. I was going to say months. It's only been weeks. Whatever. But I think he needs to be able to make an announcement that breaks through what is a really complicated news cycle. And then he needs to be able to continue to break through that news cycle. And he himself is obviously not capable of it, because we have seen that he's not capable of it, because we are living in this moment in time ourselves right now.
Right. We're here.
We're here. So we have eyes and ears like everyone, so we can make conclusions about the time that we're in. So I think he needs somebody who helps aid him in that endeavor, because I think that without any controversy or conversation around his candidacy, there is actually no opening for people to make the positive case for him. I think that the positive case for him needs to be aired over time. And I think that one thing his supporters are going to have to deal with is the fact that it's going to start as a kind of depressing positive case. And they're going to have to live with the fact that people rightfully are going to push back about him being a good candidate and him being qualified for this moment. And they're right to do that. And that is part of the process that we're going to have to go through.
Yeah.
And it is their job to be patient with that process and slowly make the case that this is a candidate that we should all get behind. And I think that they cannot do that if he picks... You know, if he picks a boring candidate to run with him, he's basically giving us all a fucking middle finger and telling us to fuck off. If he picks a splashy person who we can sort of make the argument offer something to the ticket, then we're able to have that conversation. It means that even if we argue about it, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
And us talking about it is the key to getting non-voters to show up.
Yeah.
That non-voters need a conversation to have happen near them so that they tune into it and are not just able to proceed as if nothing has ever happened and will ever happen. And, you know, it's easy to tune out the election, especially right now, but forever, for everyone.
Right.
And so we need to make it not possible to tune it out.
Right.
Yeah. Because it being tuned out is how how a Donald Trump gets elected.
I agree.
People don't show up if no one's talking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, appoint a fucking... mass murder. I mean, do anything. Just like appoint someone whose name I will remember in 10 years.
Yeah.
I had thought that Edwards was a good choice at the time, but the fact that we couldn't remember who John Kerry's running mate was for all of last year taught me that that was not the case, that he was actually a pretty weak running mate. And the only reason I remember Lieberman is it's because he's the exact reason that I didn't want to vote for Al Gore.
I was going to say, that's why Al Gore lost.
So you can make it's easy to make a choice that loses you the election by going, by spiting your voters.
Yeah.
But you have to give them a topic of conversation.
Yeah.
If you're relying on a turnout model, sure. If turnout is the game.
Yeah.
In any case, speaking of turnout,
Wisconsin had an election. This was so crazy because
had an in-person election.
I remember we talked last week about how they were going to have this in-person election. And then I remember we posted the podcast. Seconds after I posted it on the link on Facebook the next morning, the story came out that Tony Evers, the governor, was then postponing the election. And I was like, God damn it. We literally just posted this fucking podcast. seriously, it was in the rundown. It was in my Facebook posting. I was like, I'm going to have to change everything.
Right.
Which I wasn't going to do anyway. But it didn't take long for that to not be the case because he called the legislature back. And that's a Republican legislature. And they came in for an emergency session. And they gaveled in and they were there for 17 seconds. And then they gaveled out and they were like, sayonara, fuck off, come vote in person tomorrow night.
That's right.
So then it went to the state Supreme Court, who upheld, and then went to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, there was a separate case that went to the U.S. Supreme
Court. Oh, right. Oh, God.
Because, so there were two cases.
Right.
One was the Wisconsin Supreme Court that overruled him in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Because he tried to issue an executive order after all of this, and everyone was like, no. the DNC, meanwhile, sued the RNC because they wanted to extend the absentee ballot deadline by a week.
Right.
And they the absentee request rate went up something like fourfold. So there were a huge number of absentee ballots. A lot of them didn't arrive in time to actually cast them.
Right, and there was a lower court ruling that sided with the DNC.
Right, and so then that went to the Supreme Court.
Right.
Where a 5-4 ruling along party lines said that they couldn't move the absentee ballot postmark the absentee ballot postmark date, and so any ballots that were postmarked after election day would be thrown out, even though a lot of people had not received their ballots because there was a huge influx of requests for absentee ballots.
Yep.
And therefore they disenfranchised thousands of people and created a terrible precedent and basically gave us our newest whiff of Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
Because the Supreme Court chose the winner.
There are a lot of people sort of looking at that Supreme Court ruling who are rightfully scared about what that could mean going forward. I mean, they literally, and I'm using that in the right way, basically threw out thousands of votes.
Yeah. And then also required that people risk their lives to vote in person, which if that's not a poll tax, if you have to potentially give up your life to vote, that is a poll tax, and that's not legal.
Right. And also,
there were huge lines.
Not only do they have to put their lives in danger, and it literally was taking people all day to vote. So, you couldn't even do anything.
They closed polling places.
Right. There were five polling places in Milwaukee open, and they were supposed to have 180 polling places open because they didn't have poll workers. And so, you saw all of, the images were just horrific. People just waiting in lines that were wrapping around blocks and blocks and blocks, and people were trying to social distance. And I'm sure the poll workers in the polling places were trying to do their best to make sure that it was being disinfected and things like that. But there was just no way. I mean, the fact that people were out of their homes, just waiting outside for hours and hours and hours was truly, it was shocking, really.
And this really also gives us some food for thought about how to make sure that November's elections are done fairly, because there are a lot of lessons here for the nation. One is that it's actually really easy to disenfranchise people by not getting them their ballots in time.
Yep.
And so that's something that, especially if that kind of action is targeted in Democratic districts, that can affect the outcome of a race. And then also, the Democratic theory for overthrowing Trump is turnout, and if you either require in-person elections, then the places that are hardest hit are urban centers and close suburbs. That's where we saw the blue wave in 2018, and that's where COVID is also going to hit the hardest.
Yep.
So that's going to be the places that are both at the most risk for literally losing their lives to vote, and also at the sort of center of the Democratic strategy.
Yeah.
And so we have to sort of think about how we're going to operate, you know, there's, I think we're going to have to figure out how to do vote by mail. And there are plenty of states that do it.
Right.
But we're also going to have to think about how to make sure that whatever voting strategy we go with, it is not designed to disenfranchise certain voters. And then, you know, on top of this, for the Democratic strategy, I mean, we're going to talk about it in a second, but the African-American community is being hit hugely disproportionately by COVID. The death rate among African-American patients in the ICUs is massive.
Yep.
And that, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about why that might be. No one knows for sure why it is. But, you know, if you're talking about already communities that are, you know, for issues largely related to poverty are being decimated, these are communities that are at the center of the Democratic strategy and the center of the Democratic Party. That there, it just sort of like paints a larger picture for how rampant inequality is both a healthcare issue and also an election security issue, or not an election security issue, but an election legitimacy issue. You know, how all of these systems are related. And so we're going to have to think about that a lot. Trump doesn't want to let us all vote by mail. So the first thing we're going to have to do is convince the Trump administration that vote by mail is an acceptable thing. And the reason they don't want to is because it allows people to vote.
Right, exactly.
Their strategy is the opposite of a turnout strategy.
Right. I mean, Trump knows that vote by mail works fine. A lot of states are doing it. The military votes by mail. He voted by mail, literally, in the just very recently in the Florida primary. So this is a man who knows that vote by mail is a solid choice in the situation that we're in. But it's so solid of a choice that he doesn't want it.
That's right.
Yeah.
He said it has the tremendous potential for fraud. And unless you're talking about the kind of fraud where the GOP forced Wisconsin Democrats to risk their lives to vote, thereby depressing the turnout, there is no voter fraud. There is voter suppression that's politically motivated, for sure. There is not voter fraud.
Yeah.
There is not voter fraud in vote by mail. There is not voter fraud in non-vote by mail. There just isn't much voter fraud. Sorry about it.
Yeah. And there's five states who have vote by mail as like their only system of voting. And then there's also, you know, 2/3 of the states can vote by mail. I have voted by mail in quite a few of the most recent elections. I didn't this last one because I wanted to go use our new fancy polling machines.
Right.
But so this is not even... It's not even a crazy thing to think, because 2/3 of the states have fairly robust vote by mail.
Well, and there is a bill in the Senate that Amy Klobuchar and Ron Wyden are sponsoring that would include in the next coronavirus, you know, stimulus package, money for states to ensure that they can meet vote by mail requirement, you know, operate on a vote by mail basis.
Very minimal amount of money, considering the amount of money that we've been making up.
Now that we
recently.
Just make up trillions of dollars, it's like, it's only like $1.6 billion. So, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
No big deal. But that's something that we're still, you know, in the midst of discussing.
Yeah.
But it is something that, especially on the heels of Wisconsin, is going to be really important to think about.
Yeah.
Because we are seeing how a regime that is employing authoritarian and fascist tactics can use this event to disenfranchise us.
Yeah.
And we don't want that.
We don't.
In any case, speaking of coronavirus.
Here we are.
We are killing it at being number one at coronavirus.
Yeah.
We are now, we now just alone make up 1/3 of the world's cases.
Yeah. And this was it was so crazy. When I was taking these notes, I was just had like CNN on in the background, and there's too much information going on the CNN screen, by the way. Like if you've looked at it recently, it's often, you know, like,
I can't.
It's like an L shaped, and there's like the lower third going across the bottom, and on the right side it has the worldwide cases and worldwide deaths, and then it has the U.S. cases and the U.S. deaths, and then sort of like there's a quadrant of the screen that has like whatever is actually on CNN at the time, which is often sort of like two panels, because like they don't have anybody in studio, obviously, so it's like one person and whoever they're interviewing. My point is, I had that on while I was taking the notes. I changed the numbers probably 12 times over the span of an hour while I was taking these. So these numbers are not right. As you listen to these numbers, they're much different. But this was the last time that I had CNN on, which was only an hour ago. But they're changing quickly. Anyway, we have 547,000 out of 1.83 million cases worldwide, which is just shy of 1/3. And we have almost one fifth of the deaths. We had 21,500 out of 113,000.
That's not because we're doing a fantastic job treating everyone. It is because we are later in our, or we're earlier in our curve than a lot of countries that have faced huge death rates.
Right. Well, and we're also not, and I think this is worldwide actually, because I heard when they were talking about Boris Johnson on CNN that actually the UK is also not counting these cases, at least officially as part of the number, but we're not counting cases in long-term care facilities. Like, those are not in this number. And I think that's just because, like, they're basically, like, people are dying of sort of, you know, whatever complications they have sort of because of it, basically. Like, it comes in, like, they were already sick, or they were already, you know, 107 or whatever it was. And so they're just sort of like, they're not being added here, but like there's,
it's thousands of people, it's
tens of thousands of people, or tens of thousands. Yeah. So, or no, excuse me. Yeah. They're like, almost 3,000 people.
Yeah.
As of today. Yeah. And that's up from 450, cases just 10 days ago. So that's been a huge explosion recently too. And you've been hearing about that in the news also. That's a huge, problem, because once it gets into one of those places, that it sort of, there's no way to deal with it.
There are a number of deaths that are not being counted in the official figures because they are not being attributed to coronavirus because the people weren't tested before they died. Yeah. They looked at the sort of average death rate over time in New York City, and they showed a spike of like 3,000 related to coronavirus, but there was an additional spike of 2,000 deaths that has no attribution.
Right.
For the last month or something. I can't remember what the, time period was, but, I think the number of deaths that's being attributed to coronavirus is related to the number of positive coronavirus tests people are able to get.
Right.
And there are a lot of people who are dying either very quickly and before they're able to get to a hospital, or are dying in circumstances that seem like they just died of a cardiovascular issue or a respiratory issue, but are actually infected with coronavirus. And so the death rate is actually significantly higher than what's getting reported in most places.
Yeah.
Because those people are not at part of the hospital statistics, which is where we're getting a lot of our death statistics from. We have the most deaths of any country leading in that now.
We do.
We had the most most cases and got the most deaths.
Yep.
So we have 21,686 deaths, not including the thousands in nursing homes, and also the thousands that just aren't being attributed to anything.
Right.
And one story that we finally started to see get some airing this week, I think in part because some new areas of the country started to experience serious outbreaks in the last couple of weeks, and we finally have some stats behind that, is that the death rate for African Americans is like considerably higher than it is for other members of the community. So depending on where you look, if you look at Milwaukee County, the percentage of the African Americans make up 26% of the population there, but 73% of the deaths from coronavirus. In Chicago, African Americans make up 32% of the population, but 67% of the deaths. In Louisiana, the difference is 32% of the population to 70% of the deaths. We're seeing that across the country. And so people are finally starting to discuss why this is the case.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of obvious reasons. And reasons that maybe we should have been addressing this whole time. There's a lot of discrimination in the healthcare system. And so there's rightful distrust in Black communities about using the healthcare system.
Totally.
Or, you know, about interactions with the healthcare system.
Yep.
African Americans are more likely than the general population to be uninsured and to live in communities with inadequate healthcare facilities. They have historically disproportionately been diagnosed with diseases like asthma and hypertension and diabetes, which are chronic diseases and often cardiovascular diseases. And these are all diseases that make COVID more lethal and that are the reason they are also very expensive diseases to control because they're chronic. And so when you pair that with poverty, what you get is a lot of people with not just asthma, hypertension and diabetes, but uncontrolled asthma, hypertension and diabetes, which is even more lethal. There's been a lot of confusing messaging that has affected, everyone has been affected by the confusing messaging about how the virus is transmitted and who's at risk. Early on, there was this sort of, and I sort of pieced this together from just Facebook friends that I have, but there was this discussion happening in the Black community with sort of like a meme about how Black people don't get coronavirus because all of the early cases were happening with people who had like wealthy people traveling overseas, and those people were disproportionately white because they were rich. And so there was kind of an early meme about that. And I've seen a lot of my friends who are doctors who work in communities of color or are people of color themselves have been having to post like, hey, you guys, we also need to be careful about this because the communication that you were receiving, the messaging around this was not correct. You are also at risk for this disease. Right. So please, you know, be careful. Yeah. But also the economic, you know, the economic inequality creates a sort of secondary layer of exposures because, you know, African-American people are more likely to hold the kind of low wage essential jobs that are keeping our economy running. So we're talking, you know, if we talk about jobs like food service and public transit and healthcare, these are jobs that require you to interact with the public. They require you to not, you know, you can't quarantine when you are a bus driver. You have to show up to work still. And so these are jobs that put African-American people on the front lines of, you know, with the public in a way where they're in jobs that are often not adequately protected. You know, we're not talking about ICU workers. We're talking about jobs where people aren't being given, you know, safety gear and things like that. Totally. And so there's an economic sort of issue that just has to do with the larger sense of, you know, economic inequality that permeates our entire economy.
And that's what it sort of like gets down to, I think. And it's for so many, because even when you look at some of these chronic diseases that sort of like make COVID-19 more lethal, you look at asthma. Well, it's communities of color that are often sort of like disproportionately affected by issues with air quality. It is diabetes, you know, it's communities of color who are often disproportionately living in places that are food deserts. It's also cheaper food that, you know, causes some of those health issues, like diabetes, which is sort of, you know, too many people of color are forced to rely on healthy foods. So there's all of these things that sort of like, when you look at those health, you know, issues that make this more lethal, it's all in the sort of historic and ongoing discrimination, against the Black community and communities of color. We're seeing it with Latino communities. We're seeing it with the Native American communities as well. It's a poverty issue, it's a collection of those issues connected to each other. Right. So it's not surprising. I think if you're looking for why Black people or communities of color are more, you know, predisposed to this, it's more that, I mean, I'm not a doctor and I don't think anybody really knows this, but it's not because there's some inherent issue with, you know, being Black and COVID-19.
Right, that gives you asthma.
Right. It's all of the issues of inequality and discrimination that lead to those things, which have led to COVID-19 being more lethal to that.
And that, I mean, I think that shows you the degree to which, you know, economic inequality creates health disasters for us in a way that is actually not beneficial to our general society.
No, totally.
Not just to individuals in our society,
in regards to other things. You know, it was a huge thing in this campaign cycle, you know, talking about, you know, Black women are disproportionately more likely to die during childbirth. You know, there's a million stats that point to inequality within the healthcare system, but it really goes beyond that. I mean, the distinction here
is that economic inequality already plays a role here. So we already, we're going to see also that a majority of the deaths are among poorer people. That's obvious, because also these diseases are more likely to affect you if you're poor, no matter your race. They are disproportionately affecting African Americans because poverty is disproportionately affecting African Americans. And then on top of that, there is an additional layer of discrimination that the African American, you know, patients in a healthcare setting have to wade through because they are getting discriminatory treatment. So there is like a sort of a double whammy where not only are issues of poverty that are going to affect all poor people, sort of making COVID-19 more lethal, but this sort of additional burden that we place on communities of color and specifically the Black community, where they oftentimes are not treated fairly in medical settings, or oftentimes their pain is not taken seriously. Oftentimes they're treated as expendable by our healthcare system. Yep. That is only going to make this more lethal. So of course we're seeing that the outcome, you know, the COVID-19 outcome, the COVID-19 lethal outcomes are disproportionately affecting communities that we disproportionately, you know, sort of rob of these needed protections.
I wish I could say that I feel like this will cause us to look inward, but I fear that it will not.
I just don't think it will. I think what I'm hoping is that it shows that there is a continuum where, because this is not just going to be an issue in the Black community, it's going to be an issue in poor communities. Totally. And that includes, most white people are also poor. So that includes a larger discussion about the sort of continuum of inequality. Yeah. And that continuum is something we need to address. And that's, I think there is going to be a degree to which this is going to be transformational in sort of Trump America, in part because a lot of his voters are poor and they are going to see that this disproportionately affects their communities as well, because the virus doesn't know what race you are or how superior your race is.
Yep.
And so I think we're going to see maybe that discussion grow out of it. But I don't think that we will get to the point where we do anything to affirmatively address the additional burden that communities of color are facing because we're assholes.
Right. Well, we've been not doing it for some, you know,
But 300 hey, some odd maybe, years. So maybe we should try it.
400, right, yeah.
Maybe it turns out that ensuring that everyone has access to healthcare helps us stop dying
this
in pandemics.
Maybe this can be one of our takeaways. We keep talking about what the takeaways from coronavirus are going to be.
I think this could
Let's make this one of them, guys.
This could be one of the only ones. This could be the most important takeaway that we have.
Yeah.
So obviously we won't listen to it.
Yeah.
But Dr. Fauci did this week admit that if we had taken earlier action, we would have saved lives. And that came in conjunction with a series of articles about how Trump knew things back in January and did nothing.
Yeah.
It was a wild week for political messaging.
It was. Yeah. He said, I mean, obviously you could logically say that if you had a process that was ongoing and you started mitigation earlier, you could have saved lives. But you're right. I mean, obviously, if we had right from the very beginning shut everything down, it may have been a little different. But there was a lot of pushback against shutting things down back then. And like you said, back then, there shouldn't have been so much pushback about shutting things down. Because what we learned this week was that there were a million things that Trump knew going all the way back to January. And at the time when he was obviously like publicly lying about these things, you know, there were reports of what he was being told by medical experts. His own National Security Council was warning against this. The intelligence community out of China was warning against this. His own trade advisor, Peter Navarro, sent him a memo in January. You know, other world leaders, other governments. I mean, like, America was able to see it on the television before Trump was caring about it. But, like, even prior to that, privately, he was being warned against this being a huge, you know, giant pandemic clusterfuck. So
just know that to yourselves.
Right, exactly. He's going to gaslight us when this is over. There's been also a few good think pieces about that this week that I would recommend looking at.
A lot of good gaslighting content this week.
Right. And so just file away what he knew when in your head. So when the gaslight attempt comes, and it will. It's already happening, really.
Yeah, I mean, it happens daily. Gaslit about a new thing every day.
Right. Just remember that. And I know that you will. But you might have to remind some people.
I've thought about this a lot in relationship to 9/11 because this gaslighting element of it, it really bears a lot of similarities to my 9/11 experience, where for months we were told, oh no, it's safe. And then it wasn't safe, but we were told that, you know, we were told not to worry about it because it was safe for us. Don't worry. And then we were told that we were complaining when we brought up that it actually now facts had shown that it wasn't safe.
Right.
And that, you know, like the ongoing gaslighting there, I mean, it went on for decades, more, or at least more than a decade. I guess it couldn't have gone on for 2 decades because it was less than 20 years ago. But I've been thinking about it a lot because I'm writing a book about it right now. And I've been thinking about what made me impermeable to that gaslighting in a way that my classmates and a lot of my neighbors were not.
Yeah.
And it was literally one sentence that a doctor said to me in the midst of all of this. As we were being actively gaslit, my doctor said to me, I don't know what to tell you. You shouldn't be down there. And I have thought about that sentence every day of my struggle with that issue, because every day I was told that I was that I was making an overblown case, that I was being dramatic, that, you know, whatever. Every time that I was told something like that, I thought about that moment and it gave me something to kind of ground me in the truth. So I recommend figuring out something that can ground you in the truth so that when they start gaslighting about this, you have some grain of truth somewhere in your mind that some reputable person told you that you can go back to and say, no, wait, I'm not remembering this wrong. Because it is really challenging to stand up to years of gaslighting. That is something that I have learned the hard way. It is something that my entire community from downtown learned the hard way and that all of my classmates learned the hard way. standing up to gaslighting is tremendously difficult, and we're going to end up, there is going to be a literal worldwide attempt to gaslight us about this problem. Totally. So it's not just going to be coming from the Trump administration. So you should maintain some shred of truth somewhere. Remember right. one thing.
Let it be this podcast.
Let it be this podcast that that tells you that you did not invent this, that this was as bad as you remember it being.
Right.
So yeah, just remember us saying the sentence, this is as bad as you remember it being. Right. This was as bad as you remember it being. Because right. that has served me incredibly well, and it should be something that that other people can harness to serve them well in this yeah. moment as well. Because it's going to be brutal when they start to gaslight us, you guys. Yeah. It's going to be bad.
Yeah.
Speaking of things they might try to gaslight us about.
Yeah.
Unemployment is off the rails yeah. right now.
But remember, these aren't valid. These unemployment no, claims this, aren't valid.
No, they mean nothing. They're not. Yeah. Well, they aren't valid because they don't represent the full extent of right, exactly. economic
they're
damage.
They're not
in
valid because they're too low.
They're too low.
There was another 6.6 million this week. So we're now up to 16.8 million unemployment claims in the last 3 weeks. And we know that we've seen, you know, there were images of people, I believe it was in Florida, because their like online system went down, who like literally yeah. were like standing in a line that looked like it was a mile long, like at the unemployment offices. So we know that this number, that 16.8 million number, does not reflect the amount of people who attempted to file for unemployment this week.
I can confirm from personal right, experience right. that is the case. And also that this has one, I can remember one time in history where this was, where it was as hard to file for unemployment. And it was in the middle of California's terrible budget crisis under Schwarzenegger. Yeah. And what we used to have to do is go to the unemployment office, which was only telephones, that no one worked there. And everyone would just call all day. And then one person, when they got through, would pass the phone around to everyone at the office. And that is the kind of thing that we're seeing right now again.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. It's not great.
And that is 11% of the entire workforce. And just to put yeah. that into a little bit of perspective for you, during the Great Recession, back in 2008, 2009, it took 2 years for 8.6 million people to lose their jobs.
So in 1 month, twice as many people lost their jobs as did over the 2 years of the 2008 recession.
Yeah. And hilariously, or great. Not hilariously, but, you know, however you're looking at it, the U.S. stock market had its best week overall in 45 years this week.
The economy is fake, you guys. The yeah. economy is fake.
There was go ahead.
It's not hard to have a good week when you tanked the week before.
That's very true. But like, what gave them the confidence this week, right?
Mysteries.
Like, that's the question. There was
feelings.
AOC tweeted this week, and it was so good because there was, I think it was a screenshot, I believe it was from CNBC.
Yeah,
with the
what's
somebody,
the ball guy?
Right, Larry Kramer or something, or Jim Cramer nope. or something like that, or
maybe I can't remember.
I don't know. What
he's one of those
their
guys.
Stock market. Guy basically yeah. up there at the monitor talking about how great and wonderful the stock market was, and then the lower third that was just running on air was the 6.6 million people who filed for unemployment.
Yeah.
And she
and
said
her tweet was like,
when late stage capitalism takes
a selfie. It
so
was the
good.
Most perfect tweet of the week.
It was
possibly
yeah.
the year.
Yeah, it was
possibly
the best.
Life. Yeah. Possibly all time.
But I mean,
nobody
truly.
Knows.
Like, you can't have both of those things up on the screen at the same
well,
time and be taking yourself seriously.
The thing is, you can, and that is why you shouldn't take any of that information seriously. Well, the economy is fake.
Yeah.
The unemployment numbers are not real because they're underreporting the problem.
Yeah.
Because there are still people who don't qualify, even under this new broader regime.
Right.
By the way, I would note that anyone who thinks that the generous unemployment benefits that everyone, you know, the federal $600 yeah. a week is outrageous should know that it hasn't yet gone to anyone. This is the first, this coming week will be the first week
right.
that
that's
it goes to anyone.
Right.
Yeah. And that's only in some states.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
slow your roll on that. Unsurprisingly,
right.
people aren't loving it right now.
Right. You know, there are a lot of people, because I've seen reports about this, how there are people within the Trump administration that think that he should not be going out and doing these press conferences every day. But he's obviously like using them as basically a rally because he can't do a rally. Yeah. But they're not working right now. Because normally yeah. what you see in like a time of crisis, there's like a surge in popularity. Political scientists call it the rally around the flag effect. Like Kennedy's approval rating was 61% at the start of the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the fall of 1962, it was 74%. In 1979, Jimmy Carter had a 31% approval rating.
Poor
Yikes.
Jimmy.
But after the siege of the U.S. Embassy in Iran, his approval rating was over 50% and like reached a high of 58% before it sort of started falling off and he lost the election. George Herbert Walker Bush's approval rating was 58% in early 1991. And then after Desert Storm was over with, it was 87%. Same with his son, W, it was 51% approval rating. And then after September 11th, it got as high as 90%. It's sort of like everyone
rallied
around him.
I never joined that statistic.
Right, you were of the 10%.
I was in the 10%.
Yeah. Anyway, but you see these things, you've seen them over history, and it's fairly common that you see them. You're not seeing them now. No. There were a whole slew of polls that came out this week, and you're seeing Trump's approval ratings plateau in the mid-40s, which is roughly where they were a month ago before coronavirus, or at least before we sort of like collectively started caring about the coronavirus.
Well, he has his base. His base doesn't know anything about facts. Right. And so they're going to keep loving him. And there's no way for him to build on that base because he's mismanaging this terribly.
Well, right. And polls are showing that too, because of those polls, some of them have trend lines from previous weeks because they're doing this week on week. And those polls showed an uptick in those critical of Trump's response.
Yeah.
So not only is his approval rating not going up, the only thing that is going up is those people who think that he's doing a shit job.
Right.
Yeah. So it's getting worse as it goes. It's not getting better. We're not rallying more. We're rallying against more.
That's right.
Is what we're doing. Yeah. But meanwhile, the governors are having the opposite thing happen to them.
Killing it.
Yeah. Newsom is out there with the highest approval rating of any governor right now.
And he did not start off with the highest approval rating of any governor. He started with one of the lowest.
Yeah, not only does he have the highest approval rating, he has the highest like uptick in approval rating. Because before the pandemic, he was at a 42% approval rating. And I'm surprised that it was that low. I mean, I don't know.
What the hell has he been up to?
Well, I know, but
he fucked us on Medicare for All, and he hasn't been heard from since.
Well, that's the thing that makes me surprised that it's so low. Because the entire state here is Democrats. And like he hasn't done anything that seems like it would cause 58% of people to think that he was doing a bad job, I guess.
I think that he has. I think that his inability to achieve anything has been... He's lazy, and we knew he was lazy. Right. But we elected him because we wanted Medicare for All, and he didn't deliver. All he did was bring back the mandate, and he let it die at a time that he could have been the rallying force to figure it out. And so everyone was just like, fuck him. What did we elect him for?
If not this. But he's not being lazy now. California is now a nation state, by the way. I don't know if you heard.
Yes.
He basically said that this week. And he's like using our purchasing power to like get things for other states. So it's no wonder his approval rating went up.
He's
but
the
it
president.
Went from 42% to 83%. It doubled. It almost doubled.
He literally has the highest approval rating of any governor in the country
right
now.
And you're seeing this across the board. Like Cuomo, his approval rating is 79%. It was 47. Mike DeWine is the leading Republican on this, and he should be. He's doing a good job.
Yeah, no,
he
was the one who's doing the best
job. Republican governors. He was one of the earliest governors to close their school district in Ohio. I think that happened even before it did in California. I think their statewide stay-at-home order came after ours. But he was one of the early takers of listening to scientists. So his approval rating is at 40%. It was at 49. I'm surprised that Tony Evers' approval rating is as high as it is.
They're trying.
But anyway, Gretchen Whitmer's is high. Inslee's is high. Asa Hutchinson's is high. He's also sort of like getting some decent marks. He's a Republican from Arkansas, but they've sort of like not been fucking it up as much as everyone. But you're seeing it across the board. Everyone is doing a good job, except...
There is one holdout.
Right.
One governor has seen a decrease in his approval
rating.
And
deservedly so.
And earned it.
Ron DeSantis, out of Florida, has gone from a 51% approval rating, or 58% approval rating, to a 51% approval rating. He's 20 governors that they polled in this list. This is not extensive in that they did this for all 50 states. But he is the only one that lost support here.
And he earned it.
He earned it.
He worked hard for it.
He really worked hard. Yeah.
He did not.
Really dug in his heels showed everybody what's what.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's not sorry.
Yeah.
You know?
Meanwhile, Boris Johnson, in good news, is out of the hospital. But what's also, I guess, good news, although it's just sort of like.
It's weird news.
It's weird news because he, you know, is the leader of a party who has been, you know, previously no fans of the NHS. Is now a huge fan of the NHS.
Well, Brent, healthcare is personal to him now.
I know, right, exactly. Yeah, someone from the NHS has saved his life, no question, which is a direct quote from Boris Johnson himself.
Right.
And he went on to say, he typed out some statement, like, on a laptop from his hospital bed to be released today. And he said, "We are making progress in the national battle because the British public formed a human shield around this country's greatest national asset, our National Health Service."
A shield from him, basically.
Right, a shield from him. I know, exactly. "We understood and we decided that if together we could keep our NHS safe, if we could stop our NHS from being overwhelmed, then we could not be beaten. And this country would rise together and overcome this challenge as we have overcome so many challenges in the past." So maybe
the world is topsy-turvy. He's going to forget about this next week.
Yeah.
But but for the week, healthcare is personal to him.
That's right.
So he finally understands why people need it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it's Easter.
People went to
church. Happy Easter. They shouldn't have, but they did.
And not only should they not have, they really by law shouldn't have, because this was happening.
It was actually illegal.
Right. This was happening in Kansas because initially when Kansas initiated their stay-at-home order, there was an exception for churches. And then as it started getting worse, their governor, who is a Democrat, decided that she was going to say, no, you can't go to church. So and she issued an executive order. The state government overturned her on that, and she took it to the state Supreme Court. And just this morning, they basically upheld her executive order that she had the right to say that people shouldn't be going to church. So
what did people do?
They went to church.
That's right.
They did it anyway.
That's right.
So, I mean, I think that they're just testing her is what they're doing, basically.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, what is she going to do? I mean, is she going to send a police raid to a church? No, she's not. So
no,
like,
because she doesn't want to have that video replayed for the rest of her life about the time that she had police drag people out of their house of worship.
Exactly. So, like, I get why people felt like it was still probably safe to go to church, at least in terms of what the repercussions were going to be.
Right.
But also, like, why were you doing that?
Well, the repercussions might be that they all die of coronavirus, well, so it might not have been as safe to go to church,
I mean,
as they
even
thought.
Mike Pence said earlier this week, like, not to go to church, which I thought was surprising.
That was one of the least Mike Pence-y things that he's ever done.
It really was, yeah. So anyway.
Church. And we have one more story, but then we're going to talk briefly about the story of Easter, because that's an important Easter tradition that we don't like to be negligent.
Right. Virginia passed a great law recently.
Yeah.
The governor signed it. Northam signed it. It's basically, it's a voting rights bill, and it has a bunch of great stuff in it.
Yeah. They made Election Day a state holiday.
Right. There's no more voter ID law. They got rid of that. It also implements automatic voter registration through the DMV. It extended in-person voting times. It keeps their polling places open until 8 instead of 7, so you get an extra day. It expanded early voting. You can now request a ballot.
you just said it's an extra day, but it's only an hour. But in the time, the new world time that we're living in, an hour does feel like a day.
Like days.
So,
yes, it does. It no longer requires you to give a stated reason for requesting a vote by mail ballot.
Previously, it has no excuse absentee ballot.
Right. Yeah. No, you could just ask for one and they give you one. You don't have to tell them
as
why you need one.
Should be.
Yeah. But perhaps my favorite part of it actually is that to make room for the additional state holiday, which you don't need to make, you can have as many holidays as you want. But they got rid of one to like quote unquote make room for it. And they got rid of Lee Jackson Day, which was established over 100 years ago, which honors Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, the Confederate generals. So that is no longer being celebrated in Virginia.
Just want to point out that in New York City, the arbitrary holiday that we have that I didn't find out about till high school is Brooklyn Queens Day, which is a day where Brooklyn and Queens just take a holiday and no one else does. No one knows why. I feel like Virginia's version of Brooklyn Queens Day is Lee Jackson Day, which is a holiday where they celebrate Confederate soldiers.
Yeah.
That perfectly illustrates the difference
between
New York and Virginia. Yeah, no. Well, also, I mean, don't still have this on the books.
I know.
Don't have had it on the books in the first place.
Yeah, no.
This is celebrating a losing war. It doesn't even make any sense. It
doesn't.
In any case, let's talk briefly about Easter.
Sure.
Now, the reason that we do this, and we'll be quick because we've been going on a long time, is that I have a sort of mental block on the story of Easter. I don't have the ability for some reason to remember what Easter is and why we're celebrating it.
Sure.
I also have a new question this year related to the timing of Easter.
Oh.
Which I know sort of generally in a sort of religion-free history of Easter, we're talking about just sort of like a spring equinox, general spring harvesty holiday.
Sure.
You know, that's every major religion and every major culture has a holiday around now because it's the beginning of spring.
Totally.
So that is, Passover happened this week.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's got one.
Yep.
So I have a question about the sort of timing of Easter.
Though. Yeah, I can't answer for you.
That is, well, it's related, maybe you can, you probably can't. It is something my aunt actually brought up, and it is a fair question, which is how is it that Easter, which is based on the, like, second Sunday after the last full moon of the something, like, it's based on the moon. How is it that Eastern Orthodox religion celebrated on a different date then? Do they have a different moon there?
I don't know, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know.
It was a curious one.
I could enlist someone to answer that for you, probably. But
would they be answering it from a scientific perspective or from a theological perspective? I only want theological answers. I don't care about the science.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, that wasn't where I was expecting this was going to go. Yes, they would answer it from a theological perspective.
Yeah, great.
Would you like that answer?
Obviously.
Do you care enough to have that answer?
Yeah, I want an answer.
All right, great. I'll get it answered for you.
Great, good, great.
As it turns out, I'm a churchgoer, but not a theologian.
Surprise. But let's talk briefly about what is Easter.
Well, Easter is the resurrection. That's when Jesus rose from the dead after he was crucified.
When did he die?
On Good Friday.
Oh, Good Friday is the... Oh, right, because when Trump wished everyone a happy Good Friday...
Yeah, that
meant nothing. That just went right over my head. I was like, oh, okay, I guess. But you're not supposed to be happy on Good Friday. No. But it's confusing because they call it Good Friday.
Yes, but that's a somber holiday.
What's Ash Wednesday? That's not related to this.
It's the beginning of Lent, so it is. Because
that's okay.
The Lent is the season that ends on Easter. So Lent is now.
So everyone can go back to eating chocolate now.
Correct.
Great. Okay. Yeah. So Easter itself, the Sunday of Easter.
Yes.
A miraculous thing happens.
That's right.
After what is already a pretty miraculous thing happens, which is a human person is crucified, which is a weird way to kill someone.
Yes.
Kind of a gross
Three people were crucified that day.
Who else died? You know that? No.
Some other...
Christians? You
know, some other folks.
Christian? Yeah. Other Christians?
Criminals.
Criminals. Oh, criminals. Oh, because he was a criminal because he was preaching stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel like at various times in the past we have had... an in-depth discussion about where was he in a cave? Was there?
Yes, there's a tomb involved.
There's a tomb involved. I think I at one point held the line that maybe he got accidentally buried alive because that used to happen in the old days a lot.
Mm, sure.
But then I also
it's a theory.
Wondered if there was just like a naked Jesus running around wild post all of this.
Yes. Yes, he was. He showed himself to people afterwards.
He did.
There's a period where he was around.
Spotted.
After. Yes.
What was he doing? Mm-hmm. He was just hanging out?
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah.
Telling people about life in the crypt or whatever?
Sure.
But then what happened to him after that?
Yeah.
So then he's alive.
Then he ascended into heaven.
Oh, he didn't just die of old age after that. Hand.
What's that?
He didn't just die of old age after that. No. There's too many steps to this story.
Because he was already dead.
So he's like the undead. He's basically a zombie. Yeah, zombie Jesus. We've talked about zombie Jesus before.
We've gone down that road before, yeah. Yes.
I think that the problem that I have is that there are a lot of steps, but they don't follow a logical pattern because everything that happens in this story is not something that happens in life. So,
well, that's fair.
It's just like a crazy story where someone dies.
That's
okay. Like
sort
I think,
of the whole, that's the whole thing
it's,
with faith.
Right. So I feel like somebody dies being crucified. That's a weird way to die, but I believe that you could die being crucified. It seems mean on the part of the murderers.
It does.
A little gruesome, a little gross. Whatever.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Then it follows just like a series of, there's like a logical step that I miss because we end up getting into a place where like a series of weird things happen, but they all happen in a row. And I can never remember what row it is what the order is. Because I feel like does Jesus also ascend on Easter? Was that? Do we not know when he ascended?
Maybe.
Was he just walking around?
See, I don't know.
It's not as straightforward a mythology as Christmas.
No, Christmas is an easier get.
Where you're just like, someone was born, it was exciting, we're getting presents because of the excitement.
Sure.
This is like, but this is more important than Christmas.
I mean, ultimately. I mean, like, you know, if you're a person of another faith, like, you can acknowledge that Jesus might have been born. But right. that doesn't, like, it's the acknowledgement that the crucifixion and the resurrection happened. Right.
That is where you,
is that's the Christian part.
Right.
So, like, in turn, I mean, people obviously, like, celebrate Christmas because that's fun because you get presents.
Yeah, that's a secular holiday that basically Coca-Cola and Montgomery Ward brought
but
us.
But, like,
yeah.
when it you really get down to it, I mean, like, Holy Week and Easter is, like, what is making Christians Christians.
Right.
As far as, you know, what it is that
Well, that's essentially, you have a little bit of that on the like, Passover is a much more important holiday than any kind of winter
than
holiday.
Hanukkah is.
Yeah, Hanukkah's a fake Hanukkah's holiday. That's not even a real holiday.
That's a very recent sort of thing that was invented so they could also have Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Because everyone likes Christmas, as it turns out. If I learned anything when my parents moved to Beirut.
People like presents.
Yeah. People like presents. They love hot cocoa. They love decorating dumb, unnecessary, you know, holiday things.
Totally.
People love, you know, snow. It's got all the things you would want in holidays. Yeah, people like peppermint. Everything. Sure. That's everything you need. This one is... like theologically speaking much more important, but I have one final question, which is, how do we know that when he dies it's for everyone's sins? Does he tell us
because
that?
That's the
we just have to know that.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is that he is sort of like incarnate of God, right? He sort of is like, he is God,
but
ultimately.
Is he the whole time, like, the idea... or just after he's crucified? Like, the whole time he's God?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's born.
So, like, the idea is sort of, like, he is, like, God incarnate on earth, who was sort of, like, came to earth to sort of, like, be of man and sort of, like, take and, like, you know, in death, sort of, like, that's where we can.
Is a less biblical way to phrase that just that he wanted to, like, hang out to find out what everyone was up to?
Sure. Let's go with that.
I feel like being of man sounds... like, I get it, but I also, like, don't know if it's supposed to imply something metaphorical that I don't understand.
Sure.
So he's, like, here, he's hanging out, and then they kill him because they're mad because he's God. Or do they know he's God? Why do they kill him? Why does he die?
Well, he is preaching, you know, because he's himself Jewish, obviously, at this point. So he's going around teaching in, you know, Jewish temples that, like, he's the Messiah, basically.
Oh, you know what this reminds me of? Is a story that I recently read about the founding of a megachurch in Southern California. Where
great.
A guy...
let's go with this metaphor.
Who is sort of like a hippie. Like a hippie Jesus type.
Uh-huh.
Or a hippie, just a hippie, who finds Christianity. And then becomes... right. He doesn't himself claim that he's a god, but he does start referring to himself as a prophet. And he kind of helps found the whole megachurch movement in Southern California.
Interesting. Who is this?
His name is Lonnie Frisbee.
Yeah, it is.
But there is this whole movement in Southern California in the 60s and 70s, this Jesus movement, or I think they were sort of calling themselves, after they took it back, Jesus Freaks. But it's like this hippie Jesus movement that basically leads to the founding of a bunch of really popular California megachurches. And also is really it's really instrumental to the founding of Christian rock. They kind of begin the kind of transition from praise music to popular music. And the sort of melding of the two, they kind of, you know, they find some of the first major Christian rock acts come out of this movement. So it sort of feels a little bit like... it's sort of reminding me of that. Like a guy who's theoretically of a different religion decides that he is of another religion, decides he's founding a new aspect of a traditional religion, and that leads to its own movement of non-denominational churches, in this case, that now potentially spread disastrous messaging to everyone, which, you know, is a side effect of this sort of thing. But he's just walking around. He wasn't actually being of man in the sense that he was just like being a regular guy.
No, he was like he was preaching and he was going around. He was going around doing miracles.
Oh, sure.
People
got to do those.
That.
People love miracles.
Yeah,
Well, that's a good party trick, too. I mean, if you want to get people's ear, if you can perform a miracle, you might as well go ahead.
Yeah.
But then he couldn't perform the miracle of not dying in the first place in this crucifixion.
You know what? We're getting into territory that I don't know how to deal with.
This is how... I think next year I still won't remember the story. And the reason I don't remember the story is because I picked too many logical holes in it, and then I can't keep track of what was real and what was my own confusion about the story.
Fair.
I did celebrate today by eating a Cadbury cream egg.
Amazing. So, I want one of those.
Yeah, that was the most... Easter is actually a very important holiday to me.
It's a good candy holiday.
I would argue the best candy holiday.
I think you're right. As far as just like if you're looking for candy.
Right. If you are just thinking about the candy offerings of a holiday, people want to go with Halloween, but they're neglecting the fact that Easter is actually the best candy holiday. There's nothing, and Christmas is the second best candy holiday. Halloween is a bullshit candy holiday because it's a fake. Because
it's just the same.
It's the same candy. We just eat more of it.
That's right.
There's not special candy for Halloween.
Maybe it was like different wrappers or like orange food coloring in it or something like that.
But it's
like,
not, you know.
Because even Cadbury cream eggs have like. Cadbury scream eggs. Yeah. Which is like.
They're disgusting because they're green inside. Nobody wants that.
No. Ew.
But it's I did eat a Cadbury cream egg to celebrate the resurrection.
Great. Good.
And so we will end it on that. We hope everyone had a good Easter.
Yeah.
Or a good Passover if you celebrated last week or are still celebrating it because it's, I guess, still going on. And we will be back next week with news and updates, I guess.
That's right.
We'll still be in our homes. Our stay-at-home order has been extended.
Yeah,
so
May 15th.
Looking at a lot of time at home. So we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.